Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 10, The Final Journey. And we're going to have a really good one tonight, I think. It's going to be really interesting because it was funny. As I was sort of looking at who to bring on the show this week, I was looking at, like, the last – I mean, we had just done this the Jack Brewer show, and it was like we just spent 3 hours deconstructing ufology, so I can't even fucking go there again. And we had just done Tim Weisberg and Chris Balzano the week before and deconstructed ghost hunting, so it was like I can't really do ghosts either. You know, and then I went even further. Well, we just had Ken Thomas on. We deconstructed conspiracy theories. So it's like, ah, shit, man. I don't know what the hell we're going to talk about because I kind of, like, talked myself out of all this stuff, you know, over the last 3 weeks. And then I noticed my buddy here, our guest tonight, Walter Bosley, he's had a lot to say lately about this secret space program. I don't know what to call it, really. And we'll kind of get into that, but I guess genre, for lack of a better term. It's like not ufology. It's not conspiracy. I guess it's conspiracy theory, but it's sort of this concept of a secret space program and how it's all of a sudden really hot, and that's what they made. That's what they did the whole MUFON, you know, that was the theme of this year's MUFON symposium was secret space program. And I think they even have done secret space program conferences and stuff. So it's getting more and more popular. And as with all of these fields, as they get popular, then you get some bad apples, and, you know, they starts to go off the rails a little bit. And that's kind of what's going on with the secret space program scene. And I don't know really anything about it, so it's perfect for a discussion here on the show. And Walter's done some tremendous work. He's been writing about this types of stuff for a long, long time. He was on the show way back, I don't even know, but he was talking about Latitude 33, his book on Disneyland and sort of like ley lines and stuff like that involved with that. So he's been on the show before. He's a good friend. Hung out with him at Paramania out in L.A., and he's back on the program now. Welcome back on the show, Walter.
Hey, Tim. I'm really glad to be back on. It's always good to talk with you.
Nice, nice. Yeah, man, like I said, it's funny. I sort of was looking to get you on the show. Wasn't really sure when to make it happen, and then you've been posting a lot on the thing, and as we were talking about this right before we went on the air, you posted a video clip of some, like, very overly long video interview. Mm-hmm. I only watched, like, the first 2 minutes, because, like, in the first 2 minutes, the host, this lady, who I can't name her because I don't know her name, was like, introduced Corey Good, who's one of these secret space program quote-unquote whistleblowers, and she was like, he was inducted into the space time travel core at the age of 6, and then he traveled back and forth to space and time, and you know, 4 different times, and I just shut it off at that point. I think she was going to say he was, like, really 160 years old or some shit, but it was like, lady, get the fuck out of here.
Right.
Like, who the fuck is listening to this lady? Who's watching this lady's show? Like, that's not, you know, your credibility's right down the toilet when you introduce someone. You're like, at the age of 6, he was, if you're going to say that, dude, just go, he says that at the age of six, he was inducted into the, you know, toddler astronauts. Not like he was. You don't know that lady. So then I'm like, I got to get Walter Bossi on the show because he's on these people. He knows what the fuck's going on. So that's how, sort of how this came together.
Yeah, I've been, yeah, absolutely. I'm with you. The frustration there on that particular video, it was, that is indicative of the kind of stuff you see around the whole Corey Good thing. You know, they just drink that Kool-Aid and they state this stuff like fact. And of course, that's the shtick over there, you know, whenever, and this has gone on for decades. It dates back to the old contactee movement, the marriage of the UFO question and the New Age stuff. Now, again, I'm one of those guys, you know, who you hear, you know, like all of us, we all have friends in the, that are involved in that New Age culture. You know, I have some very good friends that are in it. I do not dismiss everything in the New Age culture. I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, okay? There's some things in that philosophy, that way of looking at things, that I think are legitimate. But there's also a lot that's a bunch of nonsense and crap. And we often see the nonsense and crap emerge heavily when it's associated with anything to do with UFOs and such. And the frustration that I've been expressing, and I'm not the only one that feels this, is this, what you'd call this, really appropriation of the secret space program idea with this New Agey UFO nonsense that, you know, guys like Corey Good put out there. And not just him, there's others. He just happens to be the guy who wants and has the spotlight, so he's going to get it. But for the listeners who may not be familiar.
Yeah, I'm not even sure where we. Yeah, let's sort of thumbnail them in here on this because.
Yeah, the idea of the secret space program is something that is kind of an offshoot out of Richard Dolan's label that he came up with, a very good one, for the breakaway civilization.
Right.
And that meant a group of people who had the resources, financially, material, you know, and such, to develop their own technology separate from what the rest of us are aware of or the rest of us use, and kind of create their own thing, you might say. Now, it in concept, my understanding of Dolan is, you know, this is not some Hollywood type of society that lives on a moon base.
Right, right. They're not living on the inside of the Earth or some shit like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's they coexist with us here. They go to our malls. They go to the restaurants, you know, in our towns. They, you know, well, our towns if you live in Beverly Hills or something. But, you know, you get the idea.
Right, right. They're just, like, super wealthy, and so they, like, if they get cancer, they just take a pill or some shit. That kind of thing.
Exactly. But included in this technology, of course, is aerospace technology that is produced along a parallel but different or maybe perpendicular technological course there. And, yeah, you know, the idea is that they have access to outer space, you know, off-planet travel, that kind of thing.
Right.
And that's where the secret space program emerges from, this breakaway civilization idea. And very specifically, it has been up until, you know, I'll say guys like myself and a couple others that have been sticking our nose into this whole Del Shall mystery, which I'll explain shortly.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that the secret space program emerged from World War II, from what Nazi Germany was developing, and then with the rise of the post-World War II military-industrial complex, primarily of the United States, that's when the secret space program started to develop, okay?
Yep.
Now, I personally have taken it back to the mid-19th century. And you know, in my research, I have presented the rudimentary proof of concept line of development starting in, or at least going from a starting point of the 1850s. And that has to do with a guy named Charles Del Shall,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, a lot of your listeners might have heard of him. Many probably have not. That's a whole other thing. My book, Origin, the 19th century emergence of the 20th century breakaway civilizations goes into that very deeply. And so, you know, it's all a nuts and bolts, it's all an historical-based line of research in which, you know, we look for, you know, more of the academic kind of proof.
Yeah,
you know, we're looking for a documents-based, a down-to-earth-based line of evidence when we, you know, talk about the secret space program. And there have been guys that have been researching this for years, you know, researchers that have been writing about this, people like Joseph Farrell and Michael Schrad and Mark McCandlish and Catherine Austin Fitz and, you know, some other, you know, several other speakers who have spoken at the at two of the Secret Space Program conferences that I've been involved with. I spoke at the one in 2015 in Austin, Texas. John Brandenburg is another one. And, you know, people familiar with this MUFON event that we'll talk about shortly will recognize that Schrat and McCandlish and Brandenburg and, you know, Dolan himself, as a matter of fact, were all speakers at this MUFON event. That's the positive, about the only positive thing about that event that we'll talk about. But, you know, these are all people that have been, you know, working hard and digging this stuff out. And Catherine Austin Fitz is, you know, financial trail. You know, she does the classic follow the money. And she points out, you know, how they could have financed this. Well, this has been going on for years, and it's very they've worked hard to keep it down to earth and present evidence-based research, okay?
Right.
And back in 2015... there were people that were just constantly sending emails to the guys running the Secret Space Program conference, you know, the one in Austin, of course, that was in San Mateo the year before. Mm-hmm. And they were complaining that, you know, how can you have a Secret Space Program conference without Corey Good? Without Corey Good.
Now, who is this? Now, I'm going to just jump in so we can kind of like fill in the blank. Who is this? Where did this guy come along? Because I've never heard of him.
That's what I was getting to.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, all his essentially lackeys are doing this open, you know, complaining about this. And then right before, about a week or so before, a couple of weeks before this event in 2015, people involved with him were actually using the graphics of the Secret Space Program conference that they were not involved with. You know, they were lifting these graphics and they were using that to do a clickbait for Corey Good and David Wilcox's whole thing, okay? And then they, Wilcox and Good, came up with their own online conference that started the day after the one in Austin ended. Now, while Austin was going on, I spoke on the first day, and at the end of that first day, we had our panel of speakers, and they had their, you know, their shills in the audience that brought him up about two or three times in the Q&A. The very first questioner, young lady, intelligent young lady, you know, she seemed, and brought up, you know, Corey Good this, Corey Good that. So what they tried to do was force inject this Corey Good guy into the event at which really he had no place.
Right.
Because they worked hard at this event when they were having it, that to not have the whistleblowers, to not have the storytellers, to not have speakers who didn't present some type of, whether people accepted it or not, some type of academic evidence. So, yeah, the question was, in my mind then, it's like, who in the hell is this guy? You know, what's going on here? So that's when I first learned, you know, looked into it and learned about the, you know, the whole Corey Good shtick. And
yeah,
to answer your questions. Yeah, what that is Good claims basically that he was in some time-traveling space commando unit. they're calling it now the 20 and back. They picked him up when he was 16, transported him off planet. He spent 20 years as a star-traveling airborne commando fighting, I don't know if it was reptilians or whatever, fighting aliens. And then after he served 20 years in this special ops military unit, they put him back through time, back into his 16-year-old body, merely 5 minutes after they had taken him.
Oh, shit. Okay. All right. Yeah, so now I'm filling in the blanks on what that lady was trying to say. That's even worse. She's saying, like,
he has
the wisdom of an 80-year-old man in a 40-year-old dude's body or some shit. Yeah, okay.
Well, that's, you know. Now, here's the thing. As he's gone on, you know, he comes out, and as he's gone on, the story, of course, is built and more stuff has been added, and now it's this thing where he's some type of Galactic Federation ambassador between this alien race called the Blue Avians. They are bird people, and they're from, you know, this other world, and he's an ambassador between them and us, and he's here to, you know, be their voice and, you know, all that revelatory nonsense that New Agers just love.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And
oh
he
God.
Provides no documentation. Okay. He apparently was in the Texas National Guard, and there is the Texas state equivalent of what we call a DD-214, which anybody that's been in the military, around the military, knows that the DD-214 is your discharge paper that is really your receipt. It's your stamp of you were really in.
Yeah.
It's not always a stamp of approval because it tells you what kind of discharge you got, whether it's honorable or dishonorable or otherwise.
Right, right.
And but the closest thing he's got is his Texas State Guard form, equivalent of a DD-214, in which essentially he was an IT guy. Okay, so I want you to, you know, it's your classic computer nerd
dreaming
guy
of something.
How to plug in the cables and make the office equipment run, you know.
Yeah.
But he actually was a space commando, you know.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
Again, there's people that are just eating this up with a spoon. And
now,
that's
okay. Go ahead, yeah.
I'm just saying, that's okay in itself, but, you know, there's issues when it starts being married up and when it starts appropriating other things that it really has no business being associated with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like the turd in the punch bowl, you know. It's like, if he wants to go off and do his own shit, that's cool, but, like, you know, it seems, if it's not to sound too conspiratorial, but, like, the way you made it sound like it was so organized, it makes me almost think that it's, like, some kind of, like, disinformation situation where they're like, okay, we need to inject a crazy guy into this mix so people don't take the secret space program stuff seriously. So let's
exactly. That's been thrown out there. And I talked about that in one of my recent vid reports where, yeah, I think essentially there's one of three things going on, you know, three possibilities. One of them is, you know, and we're talking about there's Corey Good. Now, there's also Andrew Basiaggio.
That's when I said now a moment ago. That's what, for some reason, Andrew Basiaggio is kind of like my, what's that, guilty pleasure in a sense, where it's like his stuff so wildly, like, over the top that I can kind of, like,
yeah,
you know, I kind of appreciate it in a sense where it's like, okay, dude, this is, you know.
So bad that it's good, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. But,
yeah.
But blue folks in this thing.
Yeah, I have, I've shaken my head and just, you know, laughed in frustration over his stuff, too. But, you know, I will say this, you know, when I was expressing some commentary on the social media here a couple weeks back, shortly before the MUFON conference, he jumped in on the thread. I believe it was on Randy Moggins' thread. And he jumped in. To his credit, you know, he didn't come in like some a-hole or anything. He expressed, you know, kind of some agreement with the frustrations that I and others like myself were. And he even said that, you know, he intended to express that at the conference. Now, I did not attend the conference. The budget didn't allow for it. It was really expensive. And but I wasn't able to. So I don't know if Basiaggio delivered on what he said he was going to do or if he just jumped in there and scooped up the spotlight that they were given. I did hear that it was quite an interesting closing panel, and it got contentious at times. And from what I understand, Dolan did indeed stick to his word and you know, pretty much express the things he said he was going to, and that I respect. You know, you're talking about Good, you're talking about Basiago. And then, you know, there's the other guy that that spoke there, Tompkins, William Tompkins. And, you know, he is a verifiable, you know, veteran. I do believe he does have a DD-214 and such. I think he was Navy. I'd have to look again. And, you know, I don't really at this point buy his story, but, you know, at least he offers, you know, and people don't buy my stuff. Yeah, that's okay, you know. But at least Tompkins offers some type of documentary evidence that he is who he says he is. He was what he says he was. And, you know, that's more than the other two guys offer. And again, going back, you know, that's okay. If people want to hear the stories and these so-called whistleblowers and stuff, that's great. But here's one problem I'm having is I just heard James Clarkson, former investigator at MUFON, who just, you know, resigned.
Yeah.
In an excellent interview with our friend Greg Bishop. And what concerned me was Clarkson, and it's probably because he just hasn't researched the issue, but here he is, you know, probably one of the better top UFO investigators out there, and his statement was that, you know, Corey Good is the primary advocate for the secret space program field. Oh, I just about jumped out of my skin.
Right,
because
right, yeah.
Because there's no way in hell that anybody who's serious about it, you know, no. Corey Good is not the primary advocate for the secret space program research. He might be the darling of the silly media, you know, the...
Yeah, that's you hit the nail. Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
he's
like
the darling of the guys who are just trying to make a quick, big, fast buck off of his nonsense. We know who they are.
Yeah.
But he is by no means and should by no means be considered the primary advocate. And this is what I was getting at with that is this is part of the problem that secret space program, serious secret space program research is having is the UFO people out there, they don't know enough about it. They're not looking at it. They reject it because too many of them are just in love with their, you know, their precious ET theory.
Yeah.
It's got to be ET. That's what they want to hear. And the grayer, the better. So they don't want to
hear. Yeah, they don't want any fucking blue aliens, dude. No, that's...
Yeah, exactly. They don't want to hear that maybe 90% of the UFOs out there are actually, you know, some type of advanced human technology. They don't want to hear that, so they tend to ignore it. And that's how we end up with a smart, excellent investigator like James Clarkson, you know, making a comment that Corey Good is the primary advocate for the secret space program. He really needs to bring himself up to speed and his colleagues and peers up to speed on this because I think serious UFO investigators that want to do nuts and bolts research and serious SSP researchers really have a lot in common and would really click if the UFO guys would just come up to speed on the serious secret space program research. I think that would be, that's kind of a research marriage made in heaven right there that would be unstoppable. But you know, it's just going to take some education.
Yeah. Well, that's why we got you on the show tonight, because like I said, I saw your posts, and I'm like, I got to learn more about this secret space program. I took the initiative, so hopefully other people do as well. It's yeah, it sounds like there's like a war on here for the soul of secret space program research, in a sense. I'm being as melodramatic as some of these folks are, between the serious researchers and... I think I saw you sort of put it this way. I think it's probably the best way to classify them, and you have to do it in quotes, folks. We don't mean literally the quote unquote whistleblowers, the ones
right.
who claim all this shit that they don't have any. They're just telling fantastic stories, and
right.
you know we don't know if they're true or not. That's you know to be fair,
well,
but at the same time
the
I don't
is,
fucking believe them myself.
They're not verifiable. They're not falsifiable. That's just it. They other than they don't pass the bullshit test.
Right.
But you know, people are weird. Somebody tells a wild people in this community we're talking about here. They have this weird I don't know if you call it an ethic or a principle or whatever, in which somebody can say the wildest, most ridiculous thing, and if you come out and just, you know, throw the bullshit flag on that, some of them, they just get all over you. They say, now, you know, you got to be fair. This could be true. And you're like, folks, come on. He might as well say the moon is made of green cheese. You know, there is a line. Now, some people would say, oh, God, that Bosley guy, look at the crap he writes. You know, here's the difference between that Bosley guy and these so-called whistleblowers. In my books, I identify 40 or 50 times in my book that I am speculating and when I'm speculating, and I do my best to footnote my books and provide some type of documentary evidence or some type of historical evidence to point to. Whether the reader agrees with that in the end is up to them. I never just come out and say, this is true, take my word for it.
Right.
I don't do that. And there's the difference between myself and my, you know, other people who I've mentioned who are far deeper and more learned in this than I am, and these other guys, these so-called whistleblowers. That's a big line, you know, that
yeah,
needs
for sure.
to
yeah.
be acknowledged.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you say, are they sort of like, you said they're kind of like co-opting the serious research. So they're sort of like taking the shit that, you know, serious researchers are uncovering and being like, yeah, see, this backs up what I say. Is that kind of what's
yes.
happening, or how's that?
Yeah, that kind of stuff goes on through implication, through insinuation. What's interesting is, you know, you got the folks who have done all this groundwork, and then somebody with just deep pockets full of money that wants to fill them with even more money, they stand up a silly media kind of situation, and they give the spotlight to the wackadoodles.
Right.
You know, these nutty so-called whistleblower guys, okay? And that sucks all the attention, you know, out there. And, you know, of course, at the same time, they're vacuuming up as much of the money that they can get their hands on, too. That's, you know, and I'm not against making money. I'm a capitalist, okay? Don't get me wrong here. The result is that they have so many resources to kind of hit the public, this particular public interested in this stuff, heavy, so that, yeah, people, the average person comes away thinking that Corey Good is the face of secret space program research,
right.
See, because they're not hearing as much, if at all, they're not hearing as much about Joseph Farrell or Mike Schrat or Catherine Austin Fitz, unless they're listening to very specific, you know, outlets or something. They sure as hell are not hearing about me, you know, because I'm not as big as those guys. I'm kind of, I guess you'd say, championing the researchers that have done a lot more than I have in this field.
Like a lazier show, if I was lazy, I would have just got Corey Good, you know what I mean? But it's like, I actually want to get to the bottom of this shit. So it's like, but I can see how that happens, you know what I mean? Someone's like this guy's misconception about the SSP field, where it's like, all right, who's the lead? Who's the main guy in that? I could see how people get kind of tricked into thinking that he's the face of this shit just because he gets all the fucking attention.
Yeah, he uses the phrase.
Cycle.
Yeah, what it is they'll use the phrase. You know, you get the memes, you get the catchphrases, you get the buzzwords, and what these whistleblower, you know, people do is, you know, they hear a buzzword that they like, and then suddenly, you know, they incorporate that, and it's been part of their thing all along. From my understanding, there's a controversy over this issue of this thing that Basiago calls the jump room. There's a guy, I think it's Bill Ryan, says that, you know, he was the first one to use jump room, and particularly within this context. And then he says, this is Bill Ryan, he says that Basiago never used that until after, you know, he had used that himself. And, you know, that's just one example, you know, that I've heard recently. But, yeah, they latch on to this SSP phrase, secret space program, and because they've got all the circus money behind them, that's really what people are hearing about. So, you know, people assume that, oh, that must be the case. This must be the SSP guy.
Now, maybe I'm going crazy, but did we ever finish? You thought there were three things going on here, and one might have been disinformation.
Oh, yeah, let's go back. But I didn't get into that.
Okay.
The first one is that these guys, these whistleblower guys we're talking about, that they actually believe what they're saying. Okay, set whether it's true or not aside, okay? The option one is that they really believe what they're saying, you've got two possibilities there. Either what they're saying is true and that's why they believe it, or it's not true and therefore it's delusional perhaps, or you know, maybe they're dreaming this stuff. It's just not real, but whatever.
They're not necessarily lying per se. They're like,
right,
confused me.
Right, yeah, they believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
The other option is that, yeah, they're fronting for somebody, they're being handled, they're an asset, a media asset of somebody who, like you said a few moments ago, wants to discredit serious secret space program research. See, it's interesting that, you know, and I put quotes around this, that Corey Good became the primary advocate of the secret space program in the minds of many people after the serious researchers had laid the foundation and were making progress.
Right, right.
See,
yeah.
One of the things that bothered some of these people, and this is part of option two, we're still on that. One of the things that bothered somebody was that the guys in the organization from the Netherlands that were putting together the secret space program conferences, one in San Mateo, the one in Austin, the one, I think, before San Mateo there was one. What they were doing was insisting that it was serious researchers. There was none of the whistleblower storytelling bullshit at their conferences. They would purposely keep it out of there. And it was bugging the hell out of these people who wanted the whistleblower crazy stuff to be involved. And it was bugging the hell out of the Corey Good fans. And it was bugging them. So under the second option is, you know, these guys are building up steam and, you know, perhaps they're getting too close to what it really is. We've got to discredit the whole thing. What's the best way to do it? Oh, okay, let's take these time-traveling space commandos and let's put our backing behind them. Let's throw the money at them. Let's feed them a line of crap and tell them, you know, yeah, you can share this with the people, you know. And either A, they're wittingly doing this, they're some type of, you know, an asset who, you know, is getting paid or getting something out of it, where you know, they're going along with it to get what they can out of it, or they're unwitting. They're the guys going back to option one where they really believed kind of a nugget of this, and then these manipulators, these handlers come along and build up on their ego and feed them a bunch of crap and, you know, make them believe their delusion is true, and then they use them to do exactly what they're doing now, discrediting serious SSP research, okay? So that's option two, that they're being handled, possibly witting, possibly unwitting. And then the third option is flat out that they're lying, okay? That they're just talking crap to get attention, to get a shtick going, to, you know, make some money in the silly world of UFOs and New Age and alternative research. I mean, that is an option. And, you know, it needs to be said that they could just be making this crap up.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. There shouldn't be any hesitancy to at least acknowledge that, folks, because it's like people make shit up all the time, and it's like if you make shit up in this field and you get rewarded for it, like, that's no deterrent. That just encourages you to be more, you know, extreme in shit.
You know, there's some people out there that accuse me of making stuff up. I'll tell you right now, if I was making up the stuff that I do, I would have, honestly, I could do this. I could produce 2 to 3 times the amount of books I've been putting out, okay? I could just forget all this research stuff, and I could come out with my own series of books where, you know, I'm whistleblowing things, you know, that a little bit of stuff I've experienced and a little bit of, you know, my expertise with my military background and how to, you know, talk the talk. and walk the walk, and then a big heavy dose of bullshit, and I could put out two or three times the books I'm putting out and probably, you know, make a lot more money than I'm making. But why don't I do that? Is because I'm not – I don't want to. I just don't want to be a liar.
Like,
yeah, I'm not. I'm. You know, I'm really not making stuff up. I'm trying to get to the truth of things, and it's legitimate. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wanted to. You know, I'm trying to not interject too much because you know, I don't like the crosstalk. So it's like I was thinking as you were saying this about the how this dude's fans were getting mad that he was, and he was, you know, getting mad he wasn't included in these conferences. It's like, do your own fucking conference then, dude. Like, you know, that's...
And that's exactly what they did. And they pushed theirs heavily on the internet during the week that,
yeah, they did the online thing, yeah.
And they started it on the... Ours ended on a Sunday, and like in early November, and theirs started on Monday, you know, Monday morning. And then with this MUFON thing, they finally got their, you know, because on Saturday they had some good speakers that, by the way, had spoken at these conferences I'm talking about. Mike Schratt, Mark McCandlish, Brandenburg, Dolan.
Yeah.
You know, Saturday they spoke, and then Sunday was Circus Day. That was Good and Basiago and Tompkins. And the hoo-ha circus, and so, but they it was a big deal. It was in Vegas, you know. Coast to coast talked about it, you know, big time, and you know, it was all over Gaia and stuff. So they had their big promotion. It was expensive to go to, and such, and on and so forth. So they did. They ended up, you know, having their own, and you know, for the record, I don't fault, you know, any of the guys who spoke at that conference with them. My understanding is a lot of them were asked before they knew that the whistleblowers were going to be involved.
Yeah.
And you know what? A gig is a gig. In this field, when you get asked to speak somewhere, you know what? You do it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, no. I don't hold them at fault either. It's like, if anything, that, you know, they almost have a responsibility to go to sort of offset the craziness anyway, in a sense, you know.
Exactly.
Because it's like, shit, if I were those guys, I'd be like, well, shit, well, at least we're here to sort of keep this thing from getting too off the rails and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and my understanding is on the closing panel, it kind of went there. Dolan, he himself said this in his interview with George Knapp on the last day after the event was over on that Sunday night. He told them, you know, that a big majority of the MUFON membership attendees really reject the whole whistleblower Corey Good Basiago thing. They reject that, and they hate to see it infecting MUFON the way it has. You know, I think most people, MUFON's pretty much, they hadn't been taken seriously in a long time by a lot of people to begin with. This is probably the final.
Yeah, they're limping along like old Yeller this year, so.
Yeah. So this was, you know, fine, I'm sure they made a buttload of money on this conference, but, you know, they've probably done permanent damage to themselves. And, hey, their choice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we beat the shit out of MUFON last week, and everyone's been beating the shit out of that. So it's like an old Yeller. Yeah, we don't want, you know, they've lost their way. And if anything, I think they lost their way a while ago, and people are just kind of realizing it now. You know, it's kind of like when someone, you know, they're like, oh wait, Grandpa's really senile. You know, it's just like, it didn't just happen overnight, folks, but.
Yeah, it's not cute anymore. He really is crazy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But so I guess, well, what's your, do you have like an overarching, to step away from the whistleblowers, I guess, what's your sort of like general, and I know this is probably going to be long, but I can handle it because I want to hear it. What's your like general thesis on this, on the secret space program? Because I presume like, that there's no real sort of universal theory other than that there's a secret space program. You know what I mean? It's like there's different people. Yeah. Taking out the fucking crazy whistleblowers, like, I assume it's sort of like different theories on maybe what this thing is and how it evolved.
Well, I think what you've got are two schools of thought. One of them is that the secret space program slash breakaway civilization issue started with Nazi Germany, and but really emerged and launched from that post World War II military industrial complex. Okay, that's the original model that Dolan and others put out there and have been working on. What I contributed to this field was that I looked at the Sonora Aero Club and the 19th century airship mystery, 1890s airship mystery, and I started digging into it and I saw the threads of connection that were there. And what I laid out was an early development that led to what the Nazi scientists, aerospace engineers were doing, were fooling with, okay? And so what I've done in my research is push back the starting point to the mid-19th century. Excuse me.
All right. Push that dog back. See what I did there, folks? Oh, boy. Well, while Walter tends to the dog...
I'm back. We have these door-to-door solicitors that are just... They just don't go away.
Jesus. Is this a California thing?
Yeah.
That's like where those signs, like no soliciting, come from. Yeah, I always see those, and I'm like, what the fuck? Why do you need a sign for that? But I guess in some places it's bad.
And I pushed it back to the mid-19th century, and it's a German thread because what you have is Charles Delschau, okay, is our first and only original source on an interesting little group called the Sonora Aero Club, Aero, A-E-R-O, as in aerospace, okay? And he wrote and created these very interesting diaries starting in the 1890s and up until the early 1920s when he died in 1923. And these books are full of large-page, colorful artwork of these contraptions that he claimed in his diaries were flying machines. And the description of the flying machines indicated that they had figured out some sort of what we would call anti-gravity technology. Yes, before the U.S. Civil War. Now, this was chemical-based, and it was very, as I said, it was very proof of concept, very rudimentary.
Right.
Okay? And, these books were found just discarded after his death, and they were at an old junk shop, and they were going to be thrown out, and a man named Pete Navarro in the early 70s came across them, and he was fascinated. And he was the first guy to really dig into this mystery. And he found out that Charles Delschau was a German immigrant who had entered the United States through Texas. And according to the diaries, Delschau had come out to California in the 1850s to observe and report on this group of guys, the Sonora Aero Club, that was building these flying machines, allegedly. Okay? Now, Delschau claimed in his diaries that he was a representative of the parent organization. So, wow, now we have this parent organization based and headquartered in Germany, according to Delschau, headquartered in Germany, and it was called NIMSA. And the way he spelled it out, it was an acronym, NYMZA, all capital letters.
Right.
And he also said that the Sonora Aero Club was just one of, a few of these groups, out there building these contraptions and developing this interesting anti-gravity technology for this German-based group, NIMSA. But Sonora Aero Club was the one he was sent by NIMSA to observe and report on. And he comes out to California. Now, Sonora, California is in the gold country. It's just west of Yosemite National Park. It's a beautiful area up there. And Delschau comes out. He gets to know these guys. He likes them a lot. And he admires them. And their leader, a guy named Peter Menes, and several of the other Arrow builders, they are also German immigrants. See, so again, we have this German connection. Now, you have to remember, Germany was not unified until middle, late 19th century. So in the 1850s, we're talking Prussia, okay? We're talking, like, I think there were 48 Prussian states that, you know, became what we call Germany, you know, a few decades after this particular era. So it was distinctly Prussian in its nature and its culture. And these guys came here, and they had begun to reject what the German-based NIMSA wanted them to do with this technology. The NIMSA wanted them to develop it for military uses. But these guys of the Sonora Aero Club, Peter Menes and the other guys, they didn't want to do that. They did not want to apply it to military uses. And there was some intrigue, and Peter Menes allegedly dies in an explosion, test flying one of these things. Menes was the guy, according to Del Shao, who had the secret to the fuel, this liquid that would be applied to the mechanism that made the whole thing work. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. And
now this Menes guy and the other guy, do we know, we only know of them from Del Shao's stuff?
That's right.
Has anyone tried to, like, track? Obviously, they're dead. That's no, you know what I mean. But has anyone tracked the historical record to see?
Yes. Pete Navarro has tried it. Bill Moore, you know, who a lot of people love to hate, he's tried it. A guy named Stephen Romano, who is the owner of the Romano Gallery, and they have published the best book on Del Shao's art that you will ever find. It's really the only real serious book on it. I recommend people look that up. Stephen Romano, The Art of Del Shao. And you can see Del Shao's work yourself, just hundreds of, you know, out of the collection.
Okay, so I interrupted you there, so I don't want to
The technology that Menes had developed involved using this dripping, injecting slowly this secret formula that he had, this fuel that would be applied to the working mechanism that made the anti-gravity work. Now, here's what's interesting. This was a discovery that I have made from the existing material. There is an image that Del Shao drew of several of these aero contraptions, one in particular, very specific one, which shows what is essentially an early form of what we know as the Nazi Bell.
Ah, interesting.
That was a mind blower. And there it is in Del Shao's art. You can see this thing in one of the art plates in the Romano book that I'm talking about. It is bell-shaped. And it would spin on an axis just like the Nazi Bell allegedly did or does. And this very special fluid or serum, just like the Nazi Bell, would be applied, okay? And that would cause the reaction that would result in the anti-gravity and make the arrow fly. Now, it looks like Menes was doing this in the 1850s. Now, I talk about this in my book, Origin, because when I saw it there in the artwork, it just, my jaw dropped. You know, I threw it past, you know, the top Bell researcher that I know, Joseph Farrell, and his jaw dropped and his eyes bugged out.
Right.
And even Romano, you know, it was, you know, holy crap, you know, what the heck? And, you know, so there was one of the biggest pieces of evidence I had to show a thread from the Sonora Aero Club of the NIMSA through the 19th century to the 20th century Nazis and this alleged Bell contraption. Basically, I argue that the Nazis got the Bell concept from the NIMSA influence. Now, people say, okay, the 1850s to the 1920s, 1930s, that's a big leap. Yes, it is. If you look at the airship mystery of the 1890s, what you see is a progression of the very same technology these guys in the 1850s were allegedly developing. Okay, now I have a chart in my book Origin, which I made up, and it's part of the talk. I sent you the link on my Secret Space Program Conference presentation on all of this that we're talking about right now, with visuals and graphics for people to look at. I have a graphic, it's a chart, and it shows it kind of gives metaphorical progression so people can understand the development, okay? I show a picture of one of the Delschaux arrows of the 1850s, and just below it I show a Ford Model T automobile, okay? Proof of concept, rudimentary automobile, right? Then I show a popular image of the 1890s airship mystery craft, okay? And below that I have a 1958 Buick, okay? And then the next image is I think the S4 model flying saucer connected with Area 51 that allegedly was, you know, people popularly think of that as along the same lines of what the Nazis were developing in World War II. And beneath that, I show a 1985 Porsche sports car. So what you've got is the 1850s aero, the 1890s airship, and then, you know, the mid to late 20th century classic flying saucer, okay? And I show that these correlate with the Sonora Aero is really the Ford Model T of the Aeros. The 1890s airship is really like what a 58 Buick would be to a Model T, right? You see the progression of technology, okay? And then the S4 classic flying saucer that we're so used to is like what the 1985 Porsche sports car would be to the 58 Buick and then on back to the Model T. So you see that there's, you know, kind of like the parallel concept there. It helps people understand what I'm talking about, because that's what I'm saying with my research. I'm saying, look, this didn't just come out of some guy's rear end in Nazi Germany in the 1930s. Okay, they got it from somewhere. Now, the fact that NIMSA was very much a German, Prussian-based organization in the mid-19th century, okay, and the fact that NIMSA pops up with associations to all the spiritualist, New Age, Madame Blavatsky types that were milling around the airship mystery in the 1890s, okay, and German mystics, all right, NIMSA's there in that mix. We know that the German mysticism of the late 19th century and early 20th century heavily influenced, you know, certain leaders and founders of Nazi more mystical arms, okay? So I've shown the thread tying the mid-19th century NIMSA through the 1890s airship mystery era into the 20th century to Nazi Germany. And then, you know, that's when after that I stumbled upon, hey, look at this. We've got the bell in the 1850s. Holy crap, there it is.
It's remarkable, yeah. Do we know? And I have a bunch of questions. So, do we know what NIMSA stands for? Or did he never really say?
He never really said, other than just NIMSA. However, in two of my books, I tried my hand at figuring this out. Up until my book, Empire of the World II, Friends from Sonora, people who had attempted to translate what NIMSA meant, because remember, it was all caps, implying an acronym,
yeah,
they always thought that the NY had to stand for New York. Now,
that
this
was my
because,
first guess, yeah, yeah.
Exactly, because in the 1890s airship mystery, there's a lot of talk of airship builders and investors from the East Coast, or, you know, New York, okay? So people say, oh, NIMSA, obviously, you know, it's New York something or other. And one very good try out of all those attempts to decode it was the New York Motor Zephyr Association.
Oh.
That was a good try, you know, but I don't think it's right, because Delschaux himself, the very original source on NIMSA, said that it was a German-based organization. It was called NIMSA before the 1890s airship mystery ever happened, decades before.
Right.
So there's really a question about this New York moniker. So with that in mind, I said to myself that, you know, that, okay, there's got to be something else going on here with the language – Now, I've studied, like a lot of us, I studied, you know, French and Spanish in junior high, high school, and college and such. But then I became a language specialist for the FBI in 89, 90, and I did that for 3 years. They trained me in Russian for a whole year. And, you know, all my academic life, you know, I had kind of an understanding of linguistics. In fact, the FBI, they give you a language test that tests your aptitude for linguistics and studying languages. They use a fake language. But if your mind clicks with linguistics and things like etymology and stuff, you do very well on the test. And I scored the highest in the San Francisco division when I took it. So they sent me to Russian training. Okay. So I'm kind of handy with these kinds of things. So I decided to look at it linguistically and etymologically, and I realized, okay, I've got to look at German words for this. So I went through this long process, and I ended up, I think, with a good translation of Nimza and what it means. And what I came up with was the following. Now, to keep it simple, NYMZA is how Del Shall spelt it. Now, there's something that people who study languages will know about called transliteration. It's not translation, it's transliteration. That has to do with pronunciation, okay? In transliteration, for example, the easy way to explain it is if you have a language where they use a completely different alphabet than the one we use, for example, Russian, they use the Cyrillic alphabet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you want to teach an English alphabet speaker how to pronounce a Russian word, you will transliterate that Russian word using the English popular alphabet we use, you know, in English.
Right.
Okay?
Right. So
we'll use R letters, so to speak, instead of the Cyrillic letters. Okay? It's not the way it's officially spelled in the Russian language, but it helps, you know, the English speaker, for example, pronounce the Russian word properly. So I argued that Del Shall transliterated the name of the organization NYMZA. In other words, he spelled it NYMZA because in his mind, I argue, that was the closest way to capture the pronunciation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was when I translated it, I ended up coming up with NYMZA is actually NJMZA. Okay? And mm-hmm. why is that? Well, in German, the J is often pronounced yuh, like a Y, right? So
ah,
here you have you have this German guy and he says, okay, how do I transliterate NYMZA? Okay, well, gee, in English, the Y is the yuh, so I'll use a Y, right? You follow me? This is this guy, you know, just trying his best to transliterate this. So are there any words in German that then would fit what we're talking about here? This secret organization, and they were very secretive, this secretive organization developing airships, ultimately, you know, with a military purpose in mind, okay? And that was the following. NJMZA, I propose now, this is my speculation, I propose means Nationalistisch Jagdflugzeug Maschinen Zahlungsamt. Now, what does that mean in the best English translation? The Nationalist Pursuit Exploration Airship Program Office, or the National, you know, Hunter Airship Program Office.
It sounds almost like an antiquated, like, National Aeronautics Space Agency.
Exactly.
What you kind of
expect
it to be from back then.
Now, I've taken, you know, but I got some cold response from some of the folks that are really into the airship thing because they love their New York Motor Zephyr Association acronym. They just love that. But I pointed out repeatedly that cannot be the New York Motor Zephyr Association because it was German-based.
Hmm.
Del Shall says that, and he is the original source we have on NYMZA. So in my opinion, it must be a German translation. Now, nobody had ever attempted that I ever found a German translation of NYMZA, and nobody ever came up with NJMZA before, you know, I did, I think, in 2013.
Yeah.
And you know, I won't go into it, but I've seen another researcher out there refer to the NGMZA without any sourcing reference or where he got it from. And that's another uncool thing that goes on in our field, but, you know, that's another discussion.
Yeah, whoever did that, they can go to hell.
It's kind of not cool, but basically...
No, it's definitely not cool. I'm going to just jump in just to clarify something in my mind. Because I've heard a lot about the Sonora Aero Club. Is that also from Del Shaw's original stuff, or has that been backed up with any other sources?
As I said before, it's Del Shaw, and that's the thing. That's
okay.
Where people get caught up.
We established the NIMSA part. I just didn't, like I said, I've heard a lot about the Sonora Aero Club, so it's like comes from Del Shaw. Okay.
Yeah, if you Google Del Shaw, you're going to see a lot of people that just label him as what we call an outsider artist.
Yeah, it's on Wikipedia, yeah.
To me, labeling Del Shaw, just simply writing him off, and that's essentially what it amounts to. To write him off, you know, as an outsider artist is equivalent to when an archaeologist doesn't know what the hell they're talking about when they find something, you know, from the ancient world, and they just label it religious.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no clue what this building actually was or what they did here. I can't explain it, so therefore it's a temple and it has a religious meaning.
Archaeology,
all the time. It's their little catch-all for when they can't explain something.
Exactly, yeah. So I wasn't trying to undercut.
No, I know.
I'm just trying to sort of get the roots in my head as far as like, okay, so this is all coming from him.
Yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge that, there are people out there that will just say that, oh, he's just an outsider artist and that's it. And some people say, why can't you just accept him as an artist? Isn't that cool enough? It's like, okay, look, I have artist friends, okay? Don't get your artistic panties in a bunch. You know, I know there's art for art's sake. You know, there's a lot of fart for fart's sake out there in the arty world too, but I digress.
That's absolutely true. And I'm sure there are people who will just say, well, this guy, he made fantastical drawings and he wrote a fantastical story along with it and there's nothing to it. So, I mean, for those people...
Until you look at the 1890s airship mystery and you look closely at the descriptions and you go, wait a minute, a lot of the stuff that the actual witnesses talk about really jibes with what Del Shaw had said was going on in the 1850s. And then when you look closer again at what Nazi Germany was doing and what they were allegedly doing, again you see the resonance, and aka the Bell issue that I found within the Del Shaw stuff. Then it begins to take on more than just an outsider artist thing, because Del Shaw died in 1923. He died before the Nazis ever started fooling around with the Bell, and yet there in his work is essentially the Bell.
Right. Yeah. Well, like I said, again, I wasn't discounting it. I'm just sort of putting a voice to the skeptics. And at that point, it's like, well, then to those people, it's just like, well, then beat it. There's nothing, you're not going to get anything out of this, because if you think the guy just made the whole story up. But it's like there seem to be some things that suggest that this isn't just some dude's fantastical story. Like there's something to the story he's telling. It's like those old fucking things. Isn't that like the Troy? Isn't that the whole thing with it? Up until like a generation ago or something, they said it was all a fable and shit, and then they found it.
Yeah, I think it was about 100 years ago that it was all mythology. It was all fake. Ha, ha, ha. Laugh up their sleeves, you know. And then Schliemann pretty much found it. And then others, of course. And so, you know, they had to kind of eat some crow on that. But, you know, my view is, I picked up something from our good friend Greg Bishop, you know, this phrase, buy it or don't. And, you know, his philosophy is my view is, hey, either, you know, if you think my stuff's crap, then ignore it. By all means, don't buy my book. You know, if you just can't buy the premise at all, or if you can't even entertain the premise, that's fine with me. You know, I don't like to try overly hard to convince people. I present my stuff in my books, and I let people decide. I let the reader decide for him or herself. Now, a lot of people don't like that, particularly people, you know, there's people that want to be told by the end of a book what to think. You need need to think this. This is what I think you need to think. And when you make them choose for themselves, they don't like it. Then there's the other people with the certainty fetish. That's another thing I got from Greg, the certainty fetish. You know, everything's got to be absolutely certain or it's all nonsense. There's nothing of value there. I try to ignore classes of people.
Yeah, you can't fucking please anybody. So I stopped trying a long time ago. Jesus, you know. Anyone who's had a mother should know that. He can't please everybody. So this NIMSA now, to sort of get to the timeline in a sense, well, I guess I'm a little confused in a way about, like, so these are kind of like Illuminati types, right? We're talking, like, super rich. Like, because it's remarkable that of all the secret societies, this one's one of the few that didn't get out. I mean, it's clearly a very secret society if, like, you know, it's not... It's like very...
Yeah.
It's obscure as shit. It's obscure as hell, man. It's like really... You know what I mean? I only know you and a few other people who talk about this NIMSA group, and it's like, who was in this group, you think? Who do you think was in this group? I know you're not going to know, like, specific names, but what kind of types of people, and where... where the fuck... I assume a group that powerful is still around and sort of operating behind the scenes. So how did that evolution happen?
Well, I do have some names for you. I list candidates or suspects, you might say, that in my opinion now, again, I want to all you people that get alarmed at speculation. Yes, this is a speculation of mine, but in my analysis of who the likely NIMSA, you know, guys would have included would have been industrialists, okay, in the 19th century, German, Prussian industrialists, the 19th century, who also were into esoteric sciences, alchemy and the occult and things like that. Now, as I said, in my book, Origin, I list some of them. The first one is Karl Reichenbach. He was a chemist, a geologist, a metallurgist. He was an industrialist, you know, a German industrialist. He was a member of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, a philosopher member, okay? In my opinion, he would be a perfect candidate to have been one of the members of NIMSA. And he lived until 1869. So he was alive through the Sonora Aero Club era.
And how big do you think the core group of NIMSA in Germany is? Or would be at the time, like when it formed.
We
talking like
two
dozen people.
Well, okay. If you're talking the guys that were the ones pulling the strings and running the show,
yeah
it could have been a dozen. It could have been 20. But yeah, I mean the guys running it, you know, didn't need to be a large group. They just needed to be powerful and influential. That's why I chose industrialists. And specifically the more mystical-minded industrialists. When you're a philosopher-scientist, as Reichenbach was, okay, that had a very specific meaning in those days. That meant you were, you know, one of these guys into, as I said before, alchemy and the esoteric stuff, okay?
Yeah.
Friedrich Waniek was another one. This guy, you know, Waniek was an industrialist, but he was also, you know, into mystical things as well. And he lived, you know... He lived 1838 to 1919. So he lived all through what I'm arguing was the 19th century era of the NIMSA going into the 20th century, you know, and look him up, Waniek, you know, he was a leading German industrialist. Another guy is Karl Kellner, okay? I think he would have been somebody probably involved with NIMSA. You know, he was a chemist, well-known, you know, German industrialist. He's also famous for being... you know, one of the founders of the OTO. Okay, so, there's your candidate for mysticism right there. So
right,
you have
okay. So, from the sound of it, all these dudes died out, like, before World War II. So do you think it got, like, passed down, or do you think the society, or do you think faded away?
It got passed down, and that's where we get into the 1890s, and you have the rise of German mysticism in German society and how popular they were with, you know, the American and British, you know, spiritualists and mystic community, you know, as Blavatsky and Clara Bloomfield Moore and all of them were. And, you know, and when you're talking about Kellner, Okay, he co-invented the Kastner-Kellner process, which involved mercury, okay? So some of the stuff he would have developed and advanced with handling and understanding the properties of mercury, remember, the Nazi Bell used a mercury solution. So Kellner, some of the stuff he did, specifically with this mercury process he co-developed, okay, this would have been, in answer to your question, among the technological precursors to what was handed to the Nazis, okay? If Kellner was a NIMSA guy and, you know, he had discovered some things about mercury, you know, that ended up in the Nazi Bell process, there you go. That, I argue, is, you know, evidence of where the Nazis got, you know, some of these ideas to begin with. And another guy named is Walter Rathenau, who would have been in the late 19th century, early 20th century, German industrialist, okay? And he was chairman of AEG, okay? AEG has been famously connected to the Bell. It allegedly was the electrical engineering firm that developed and built and created and used the Bell,
yeah.
Okay? So here you have Walter Rathenau, you know, who I think would have been, you know, a perfect candidate to be one of the NIMSA guys and a bridge between that 19th century NIMSA and directly to the Nazis. Again, that answers your question. Where did the Nazis get this? Did they get it from the NIMSA? If Rathenau was indeed involved with NIMSA as chairman of AEG, the very firm that would go on and allegedly develop the Bell, there's one of your NIMSA connections right there. But, you know, there's Halmer Schacht, there's Karl Mariah Willigut, who was very prominent in the SS with Heinrich Himmler, and he was very much a mystic. And in this early 20th century German mystic circles.
So do you think, I guess the logical extension in a sense then is like they, because I guess part of, I wouldn't say what makes me skeptical, but part of the stuff that sort of I have a hard time wrapping my head around is like I could see these sort of like genius eccentrics developing air flight, secretly in a sense.
Yeah.
And sort of mastering it and shit. But like getting off world to me sounds too difficult for like, what would you call that? 18th century? 18th century? 19th century. I always get that wrong. 19th
yeah.
century like culture to do. You know what I mean? Because it's like,
yeah, sure.
I heard you on Greg Bishop's show. That's the only, like I said, that's the part where kind of stuck out. Because it's like if like some dude from the 1860s like somehow got to like Mars, I don't think he's coming back. I think it's like...
No, I don't think anyone in the 1860s got to Mars. Here's the way you got to look at it,
yeah.
Okay? Is if anyone tried this with this technology, there's no way, in my opinion, it would have been attempted before the 1890s and very likely would have ended up killing them all, you know, the minute they got high enough or far enough, you know, into the atmosphere. However, there was a guy named Oliver Heaviside, who developed this theory that, and I'm trying to find the page here in my book so that I can pronounce it right. But he had developed a theory of, I think it was called GEM, and in his theory, you could create a force field around an object or a craft, and, you know, I can't find it in the book.
Yeah, like a geomagnetic bubble or something, probably. Something
yeah,
like
exactly.
That.
Essentially, when you look at Heaviside, and I present it in my book, Origin, the fact that Heaviside came up with this, I think, in 1893 or 4, okay, the fact that a theory like that was out there, the fact that someone was thinking about this kind of thing, okay, what that does is that kind of changes how you look at it. You know, initially, you know, like you, like how could a guy in the 1890s try to travel to Mars? Well, I didn't know that Heaviside had developed this GEM in the 1890s, for crying out loud, during the airship mystery era, by
right.
the way. And, you know, then there's this weird legendary story, okay, that in 1903 someone might have allegedly tried this very thing. And I talk about it in the book. Tesla has been connected with it. You know, I got it from Tim Swartz and Sean Castile. And Tim Swartz tells me that Jim Keith had mentioned that to him in an email, that he had stumbled upon this in his research and didn't think much of it. But it's kind of interesting that it's out there. You know, there's this rumored tale of someone attempting to leave the planet and go to Mars, of all places, in 1903, okay?
Oh, wow.
And yet, 10 years prior, this Oliver Heaviside guy had developed GEM. And in the very definition of GEM, you could create a force field, a bubble, around a craft, which could sustain life support. Wow. Okay. Somebody was fooling with those concepts during the time of this rumored venture to Mars.
Right.
So that's where I admit even my proposal really has taken that wild step. Okay. But it's food for thought. It's a thread that, you know, still needs to be pulled further, and it's out there.
Right, right. It's intriguing. Because the thing is, like, the other part that, like, I sort of look at it in the context of, like, how they came to America and shit, and it's like, unless you had a ship with, like, I guess they wouldn't, you know, if you're planning on staying, you need a bunch of people. You know, you just can't send, like, two people go to Mars. They're going to look around, turn around, and go back. There's nothing you can, you know what I mean? It's like, so I'm kind of, I'm intrigued by the whole thing. Don't get me wrong. But to me, it's like, how would they fucking, you know, I don't think anyone's like, I don't think they, like, went and, like, settled on Mars, though.
Well, right. You know.
We haven't even seen it.
You're mentioning the territory where I'm not going to say either way. I mean, you know, I totally 100% right here on your show acknowledge that it's highly impractical and highly not likely based upon what we know.
That's, yeah, okay. See, that's, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's the impracticality of it, where it's like, why the fuck would you, like, why would you want to go to Mars, dude? Like, even in the 1890s or whatever, like, there's nothing there, you know?
Right.
What are you going to do? And like, okay, so we'll set up a...
Well, hold on now. Now we're going to have some fun here.
Good.
Because we sure there was nothing there. What's being talked about for the last 30 years?
Oh, I see what you're saying, like ancient relics and type shit.
Yeah, what the hell's really up there? Who the hell was really up there? That kind of thing. Remember, Tesla in the following decades talked about receiving signals. Now, there's a young researcher who really had, in my opinion, a brilliant insight, and he threw up, his name's John Batista. Okay, and he threw the question at me, what if the signals from Mars that Tesla talked about in a Popular Science article in the early 20th century, said, what if those were actually the attempts at communication from that 1903 airship that went to Mars? Oh, wow. And I said, Jonathan, that is amazing. I never thought about that because, you know, the article exists, you know, and I just, in the food for thought category.
Yeah, no,
but
that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing that Heaviside developed that, you know, really gives us pause is gravito-electromagnetism, also known as GEM, published in 1893. Okay, and it was comprised of formal analogies between the equations for electromagnetism and relativistic gravitation. Okay, and what's interesting is in GEM it was discovered that counter-rotating wheels, where have we heard counter-rotation before? The bell, it has two counter-rotating pieces, Remember that. In this case, counter-rotating wheels, and where have we heard of the rotating wheels? We've heard them throughout the descriptions, not only in the Sonora Aero Club, but through the 1890s airship mystery. Rotating wheels. Now, again, going back to Heaviside, in GEM it was discovered that counter-rotating wheels produced greater magnetic attraction than when rotating in the same direction. The toroidal mass rotational aspects of which may be applied to accelerate objects without those objects experiencing G-forces. Okay? Now, there's a guy who's figuring out how to use a technology on a machine, a craft, in this case a flying machine, that would protect the occupants from G-forces and the craft itself. Isn't that interesting? And that's in 1893. So then you go, again, I say, you go to this 1903 rumor, you know, it begins to seem less zany. A little less zany.
Yeah. And believe me, I'm in the camp of, like, I want this shit all to be true. So, like,
exactly. Yeah, you know, and me too. That's why, you know, I'm looking at this stuff. So the questions
I ask are sort of like the ones that nag at me where it's like my, you know, it's like I catch myself from totally diving in because it's like, wait a minute, because it's like, how would they, if let's say they get to Mars, right?
Yeah.
Did they even know back then that, like, you couldn't just get out and walk around? Because I'm, like, half imagining some dude, he's, like, a, you know, God bless him, he's, like, the best genius ever.
Right.
He figured it out. He got to fucking Mars. He's like, I did
exactly.
It. He's like, I'm going to get out of this bubble right now, and I'm going to fucking take a look around. And then, like, the bubble dissipates, and his head explodes, and he's like, you know.
Let's do what Noah did. Let's release a bird. Let's put a little rabbit out there. Let's see
what
happens. Now, here's the other thing. Now, consider this. This is a big doozy, okay? Who says that they couldn't have gotten out?
Yeah, no, that was a caveat to the question I should have included, that, like, we don't fucking...
I'm basing this
entirely on what they tell us. It's like...
Exactly.
I can't tell you for certain, folks.
If you put aside all prejudices that, you know, you might have or whatever, and listen to what Hoagland has been saying about Mars, and not just Hoagland, people after him have pointed out that basically we've been lied to about Mars, and, the whole thing is they could have gone up there and discovered that, by gosh, there is an atmosphere, it is livable. And think about this. Let's pretend, okay, listeners, I'm speculating here, okay? Let's pretend that they did do this in 1903. They did go to Mars. They did discover that there's a habitable atmosphere up there. They did discover this ancient civilization has been there, and on and so forth, okay? Maybe that's the source of what NASA, you know, subsequently NASA and others learned about what's really on Mars, okay? These guys for decades have actually known what's really on Mars. Now, here's my problem. And, yes, I do have a problem with my own theory about this.
That's good.
You know,
that's why,
20th century
that's why I like you, because we can talk shit and figure, you know,
I roll shit around,
and then it's like, but here's the problem with,
yeah.
I love it. Go ahead.
I have two big fat problems. One of them's fatter than the other, okay? And they're called World War I and World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got the NIMSA, who, in my opinion, they were the guys who made the Nazi Party happen, particularly the mystical aspect of the Nazis, the core Nazis who we think might have survived today. I think NIMSA was the organization, the group that made that happen, period. Okay? Now, so there you have them, and obviously they would be behind Nazi Germany, their creation. Okay? Now, if you had this, and by the way, we haven't even discussed that the 1890s airship mystery, in my opinion, was an American thing, a secret American thing going on. That's a whole other aspect of my research we haven't touched on yet. And so, therefore, also as an, you know, involved in that theory is that this group that did this in 1903 was not the NIMSA, was not a German group. It was what I theorized was the American group.
Yeah, it was like
okay?
a splinter
so,
group. This is the group that didn't want to weaponize the shit.
It was the breakaway that emerged from the first American secret space program. Okay, that's a whole other conversation. But, yeah, it was an American breakaway. Now, they did this in – theoretically now, we're pretending. They do this in 1903. They're able to do it. Now, here's the problem. they've developed this, they've done these things. NHMSA has done what it's done, and NHMSA essentially is, you know, the influence that, you know, resulted in the Nazi Party and all the things they did. Where were these groups? Where was this American breakaway? Where was the NHMSA during the World Wars? Now, World War One, you know, air power had really just emerged then. They weren't using it to its full extent. That's famous. We know about Billy Mitchell and all that, and the Navy being all butthurt and jealous because obviously air power was going to ascend, you know, and they didn't like that. And the Army guys, too, that kind of – they had a hard-on for the airplane guys and so forth. But
right,
World War Two then proved – air power, you know,
Trump's the sea power.
Yeah, was going to be it in the future. Now here's the thing. During these wars, particularly World War II, where were these breakaways? You know, why didn't we see the German wonder weapons advance and be used? Why didn't this so-called American group, you know, emerge to whoop ass on Nazi Germany? You know, how come we saw combustion engine airplanes, you know, and diesel-powered, you know, ships and submarines and things like that? How come, you know, there was this, you know, years-long awful world war struggle that was going on when these breakaways, if they existed, you know, should have been in this futuristic battle going on? Where were
right,
they?
Right.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
I do discuss that, you know, in my stuff, that their goal, you know, their objectives for their thing, this is where it comes in that they're true breakaways. Basically, they're about themselves. And, you know, they use the nations of the world as chess pieces and pawns, and more specifically, in my opinion, the NHMSA. That gets into the whole 20th century military-industrial complex, Illuminati, New World Order stuff.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that makes sense in a way, because it's like...
So
they have to give all this secret information out to everybody and shit, and they're probably
right,
like, why would we do that? Yeah.
All this stuff about World War II and setting this up to say, yeah, that's my big problem. If I say this, if I think I'm right about all this stuff I've said regarding the breakaways and the airship mystery and this group in 1903 and the NHMSA, you know, helping the Nazis. If I'm right about that, yeah, the big problem with that theory is where the hell were they during the World Wars? Now, other researchers like Joseph Farrell and such will pick that up and they'll say, oh, well, here's the answer to that, Walter. Here's why. What's going on today is the reason why they were absent during the World Wars, is what some people have responded to me with that.
What's going on today?
Well, with all the stuff about, you know, New World Order, with all the stuff about Illuminati-type stuff, with all the stuff about the elitists, okay, that it has to do with, and with today's, it brings us back to the beginning of this conversation, okay, brings us back to where the discussion about secret space program is today. What I'm saying is all the stuff I've been talking about in my research is the historical thread that brings us up to today's secret space program issue. In my opinion, there are these two breakaway civilizations that are really the possessors and the hand behind the secret space programs, okay, and they have their own conflict.
Mm.
All right? Now, that doesn't mean that nations don't have their secret space program, because, again, a whole other conversation I go into in my book Shimmering Light and elsewhere, I lay out the actual facts, U.S. Air Force historical facts, to argue that the U.S. Air Force absolutely has, they did develop it, and they have to this day, a secret space program. Now, is it on the level of Battlestar Galactica up there? Oh, hell no. No. It's
right,
just
right.
A classified manned program.
Oh, interesting. So
manned
program.
Shimmering Light. What's that?
I'm intrigued by the manned program part. Because, like, my hatred, not of people, I it's kind of a running joke on the show. Like, my hatred of NASA and shit is, like, because I'm, like, almost 40 and shit, and they still haven't gone back to the moon. I have serious doubts that they're... You know, quote unquote, you know, for real, like on back to the moon. So it's like, or officially, let's say, you know what I'm saying. And it's
when
like,
you
I have my doubts. I'm gonna fucking see a moon. Like, what kind of a shitty, you know, space agency/species are
back,
we that we could get to the fucking moon like 50 plus years ago and we can't get back? Like, what are we, fucking morons? Like, what a shitty...
Go back, give me a break. Yeah, you know,
right,
the fact...
None of it makes any sense.
This has got you written all over it. The Mets stayed in a Pittsburgh hotel that also hosted a convention of people dressed up as furry creatures.
Oh, no.
Is this Wilbon's worst nightmare?
No, it's worse than my worst nightmare. My worst nightmare is mascots.
Look at that.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What are they thinking, Bobby?
All right, let me tell you something. Here's the real story here. In 40 years worth of being on the road, traveling around this great land of ours, checking into countless hotels of all stripes, here's what I've learned. There's a frightening amount of subcultures out there, Mike, and they all have conventions.
Yeah, but you've never
and
seen
I
these people.
I want to understand one thing.
I've never seen them.
Stay away from me.
Thank you very much.